So welcome back, everybody. Here we are, Chancey. It's been a while, my friend.
Been a while. Good morning, Brad. Good morning, everyone.
Man, I can't believe it, but here we are another year older.
Yeah, it seems like it's been at least a year since we've done one of these.
It has been, actually. I think it's been exactly a year.
Really? It's been a while. I know that.
And I must say that I am actually a year older because my 44th birthday was just this last weekend.
Yeah, I'm going to turn 45 this summer.
Oh, man. I tell you what, older and wiser, ain't we?
Yeah, older for sure.
And wiser, come on.
Yeah.
Man, it's sure good to be back with you guys. And a lot has changed since me and Chancey have seen you last. I mean, goodness gracious, we went through another heck of a drought here in Central Texas, and Texas overall, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, and heck, man, my buddy's place in Bandera, they're still in a horrible drought. They're still in red. I mean, it's worse than in 2011. It just looks like the moon down there. It's awful. It's just, it's unreal how dry there's portions of that state is. It's just a little red now right there in northern Medina County and southern Bandera County.
And they're still battling that.
Yeah, still battling it. Yeah, they've had a little bit of rains, but nothing. No tank filling rains, no nothing. I mean, the streams are dry, tanks are dry. It's bad.
Well, I guess that maybe our area lakes have started to fill up just a little bit. Up the creek, up the river from us, you know, they got big rains, 6 or 8 inches, and I think that's done good things for our Central Texas lakes in that area.
Yeah.
And a good thing because the demand is increasing every day, you know, with more and more water meters and those types of things going on.
More and more impervious cover.
Yeah, more, and we're starting to see that too, you know, like a little 5-inch rain in Temple this past week. I mean, the creeks came out, you know, quite tremendously. I mean, you know, it used to take a lot of water to do that. You're starting to see the difference.
Yeah. And, you know, this is just me. It's nothing scientific. It's just like me driving around the county and going and looking and stuff. Like, I kind of use my barometers. What did the sloughs look like right now this time of year? What does my tank look like? And usually this time of year, I remember when we were kids, we were always seining sloughs, you know, getting crawfish this time of year to go fishing. But, you know, I was helping my father-in-law yesterday, and he's got all those sloughs down there in the bottom, and those sloughs aren't even halfway full, you know. So we've had rains, and the pastures look good and everything, but, you know, and I know a lot of people caught water in their tanks, but a lot of the other indicators, you know, it's still lower than normal, in my opinion, you know, like some of the sloughs and sandy creek bottom anyway.
Yes, and I mean, the heat was another factor.
Well, yeah, back to back, we had the two worst summers that I can ever remember and the two worst winters we ever been in. This winter was pretty nice, but wasn't anything like those two bad ones they had back to back a couple of years ago.
And boy, but then that brings us to this spring, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
I tell you, you drive around the county, especially in my neck of the woods of Post Oak Savannah, throughout Post Oak Savannah, I think those droughts and that winter storms, they really smoked eastern red cedars. I mean, I just know on my property alone, there's probably 70% of them are dead.
Well,
the cedar trees are dead, the eastern red cedars, not juniper, but...
And a lot of our other soft-wooded trees, like the hackberries, man, they took a beating too, man. I mean, they're falling down on fence lines everywhere.
Yeah, they're notorious for that anyway, but they're just really bad now.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird. You could drive around out through the Blackland Prairie, out there through the farm fields and stuff, and you could tell where the fences used to be years ago. And the birds set and they, you know, crapped out all the hackberry seeds and all the other fast-growing tree types and brush and stuff. And it just made natural little wind breaks and everything that's still there to this day. If you look hard enough, there's some old barbed wire and rotten fence posts in there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, back in the day when there was actually somewhat market for southern coon, and when we were in high school, you know, we'd ride around. That's when everybody knew us, and it was us spotlighting out there, and, you know, it wasn't legal, but we'd spotlight off the county road or spotlight in those fields, and all those old tree lines, you know, were all hackberry tree lines, old fence lines, and we spotlighted lots of coons on those old fence lines, you know, because they were all in the hackberry trees eating those hackberries in the wintertime.
Yeah, that must be a great food source for a lot of things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's man, hackberries are excellent wildlife food. Deer love to browse it, you know, birds love it, coons eat it, yeah, squirrels eat it. It's a great wildlife plant out there.
I put up a tractor shed not even probably 8 years ago at my house, a metal building, you know, 3-walled building for parking tractors under. And just in that short amount of time, I mean, there's already 10, 12-foot tall hackberries and elm trees growing in the drip line that we've got to find a way to take care of in some kind of way.
Well, they are a great wildlife food, and you definitely want some, but at the same time, they're also one of those problem child plants for us that, you know, we'll talk about in this episode as far as, you know, habitat restoration, what it's supposed to look like, what we're doing now. You know, they're just shade-tolerant plants. They're good wildlife, but that mechanism that was in place back in the day that we talked about, you know, that made this country fire, you know, proper grazing, drought, all those things. Well, you take any of those aspects out, then the plant community can change. And a lot of our blackland prairies, they used to be more of a prairie, are now choked with, you know, hackberries and elms and stuff, shade-tolerant plants, and even shading out oak trees and stuff like that. So
yeah, and, you know, speaking of those elm trees, Chancey just recently made a video that he put onto his company's Facebook page that he has recently activated. A good video about the two different types of elms, because I wasn't even aware that there was that many different species of elms around.
Yeah, no, just in Malham County where we're at, you know, there's several different species of elms. And, you know, it's just really neat. Some of them bloom in the spring. Some of them bloom in the fall. And that keeps them from hybridizing, you know. And, you know, some of them, like, in my opinion, more calcareous soils, like the cedar elms, they seem to do better in clay soils out in the Blackland Prairie, whereas the winged elm, which blooms in the spring, versus cedar elm, which blooms in the fall, you know, the winged elm, in my opinion, is more of a sandy creature. You know, you see it more in the sandy lands.
Yeah, and speaking of that, if you go to Chancey's Facebook page, Native Wildlife Services, you can see his video he made, and that winged elm is really actually pretty cool. I didn't know that it had little, but I guess that would be almost like a bark or something.
Yeah, it's the bark along the wings, and nearly all of them have it, you know, especially when they're young. When they get really, really big and tall, they kind of lose it, you know, when they get real tall and like high up in the tree, you know, very similar like a mesquite tree. A big old bull mesquite tree doesn't have thorns on it, really. You know what I mean? You can climb it. It's those smaller ones that have, you know, so just as the tree gets older, they change a little bit. But most of them, you'll see, they have those wings on them. And the leaves are similar to a cedar elm, but they're a little bit different. And like I said, they bloom at different periods of the time, so they can't hybridize. And then the other main one we have, which grows along the creeks and stuff and in the bottoms, and even in people's yard, lots of them in yard trees in town, is the American elm, which is a big, beautiful, you know, shade tree. It's a really nice tree.
Well, and talking about those mesquite trees and having thorns only while they're young, I mean, what an adaptation, you know, like to protect it long enough to get it grown big enough to survive without, you know, of course, mesquite could just about survive pretty easily on its own without thorns, but they handle hay cutters well and come back pretty strong.
So. Yeah, they're a tough tree. They got a heck of a root system.
They do.
Deep taproot.
Like Chancey was just talking about, that's what we're going to discuss today, I guess, will be different habitats and the habitat restoration work that he's actually been working on some. Mm-hmm. And not only Chancey, but a lot of people in our area have seemed to shift focus more from livestock production and farming to wildlife habitats on their properties.
Or recreation, you know, maybe just they like hunting a whole lot more. They put, you know, just recreation in general, you know. It's like you're saying, Bradley, a lot of people aren't buying land to make a living off of it by row cropping it or running cattle on it to, you know, pay for the land and make a living on it. They're buying it, you know, because they want land and mm-hmm. for recreation. And it could be wildlife watching, hunting, fishing, you know, restoration, whatever.
The price of property has gotten so out of hand that you can't afford to pay for it farming or with cattle hardly anymore anyways, especially in this area here. And so, you know, that being said, I guess the focus shifts from okay, well, I mean, if you've got the money to pay for it, you got the money to pay for it, so, you know, you do with it what you would like. And that's not a bad thing that people are wanting to put it back into what it once was.
No, absolutely. Yeah, you know, because so much of what we discussed in other programs, like we talked about brush management, and we talked about, you know, the tools that are available out that we use, from mulching to skid steers to, you know, cut spray, you know, just all those different episodes we talked about. But I was thinking on this one we could talk about the process. Let's take this, and then not only that, but mention some of the programs that the state has, which are really, really good programs, and they're focused for our area. Right here in Central Texas, there's programs focused for the Post Oak Savannah, programs focused for the Blackland Prairie. And the programs that they have now that through Parks and Wildlife, they've really streamlined the process. The application's easy. And it's a great, great program. It's beneficial to the landowner. It's also beneficial to the wildlife. And we can go into more detail about those programs when we get there.
Yeah, and it kind of, those programs are dependent, and rightfully so, as to like where you're located at in the county or in the state.
Yeah.
As different habitats are, you know, in different areas. And that's one unique thing about where we're at here in Milam County. We have a transition from, you know, two different types of habitats, I guess you would say.
Yeah, two different ecoregions. Yeah.
Yeah, from one side of the river to the other, really.
Basically, yeah. I mean, you got, you know, one side, it's all blackland prairie. And then, you know, I'm not going to say the Little River's a dividing line, but it follows it pretty well in places. I mean, you can just drive down Sugarloaf Road, you know. I mean, when you cross that river, it changes instantly.
Yes, and there is, I mean, there's a little transition area.
Yeah, sure.
But it's a pretty fine line there.
It really is. It really is.
And so depending on which side that you're on decides what kind of a restoration or what kind of help you can get with actually doing the restoration.
Yes, yes. So we'll just go right into it. So basically, if you're in the post-oak savanna, let's start with the PUB project. The PUB project is a project through Texas Parks and Wildlife, and it stands for Pastures for Upland Birds. And they have primary focus areas that they're really, really wanting. But as y'all know, and we've talked about it before, that I don't know, I forget the exact percentage now, but it's like 99.9% or maybe just 99% of the original blackland prairie is non-existent. It's either been farmed out, grazed out, and now it's being put into concrete, you know, or
solar panels
or other things. So much, when that got taken out, so much of what we lost was grassland songbirds. Grassland songbirds, and then also, you know, just upland game birds, like when I'm talking about like turkey and quail, animals that depend on native grasses to survive and reproduce, to nest in, so they can have brooding cover, so their poults can be able to eat insects. So we've lost a lot of that in the county, and if we haven't put it into one of those other things, you know, then we put it into improved pastures generally. Improved pastures being most of the time exotic warm season grasses, such as Bermuda grass, all varieties of hybrid Bermuda, Bahia grass, and now we've got nauseous, terrible exotic warm season grasses like Old World Blue Stems. So we're dealing with a lot of that. So the PUB project in specific, it focuses on those areas within the blackland prairie that were either improved pasture grasses or old cropland or old crop fields, and a landowner that wants to put it into native grass, native habitat. So we're talking about, I've planted the seed from them, and Parks and Wildlife, they pay this cost share program. I think the rules are the landowner has to have at least 30 acres for the project. But if they get approved and they streamline the application process so it's very easy and they have money available, then they will pay. So say it's a Johnson grass, or say that it's a Bermuda grass, they will pay 100% cost for the chemicals for the application. And they'll spray it several times in a year.
That's no light dose of chemicals.
No. Generally, what we're spraying it with glyphosate, either 41% or 54%. At 54%, they're spraying it, you know, probably 3 quarts per acre, 20-gallon acre mix, 41%. That first spray, they're hitting it with like a gallon per acre. And they may even hit it more than once. And they pay for 100% of the cost of chemical. All the landowner has to come up with is the labor to do it. He can spray it himself or hire somebody else to spray it. But the Parks and Wildlife pays for the chemical. And then not only that, top of that, they pay for the seed cost. And if you haven't looked at native grass and wildflowers, they're fairly expensive. And they're just like any other commodity, depending on the drought and, you know, everything else. They go up and they go down and they go up and they go down. But they're pretty expensive a plant, but this program pays for 100% of that seed cost, and all the landowner has to do is the labor to plant it. But with this program, they also, Parks and Wildlife, has no-till drills, Truax no-till drills, the same drills that I run. They have it, and they'll even loan it out to the landowner to use, and he can plant it himself. And like I said, when I plant these mixes, I look at it. Those guys at Parks and Wildlife, I'm just going to say one of them's their name, Tim Sigmund. He's kind of ramroads that project. And He puts together incredible mixes, very diverse, lots of wildflowers and lots of good native grasses that are ecotype specific to these areas. And it's a very successful program, and it's one that I push really hard just because it's a win-win for the state, for the animals, for the species, and the landowner.
I mean, in my experience in the Blackland Prairie, coastal Bermuda grass, in my opinion, was not exactly designed for that type of soil type. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it just doesn't, like, you got to baby it a whole lot.
Yeah, and even in the sand, it requires lots of TLC.
It does. But, you know, compared to what you're planting with the native grasses and the root systems that they have and stuff.
Sure.
But on the same token, like you said, it takes a lot of chemical to get rid of Bermuda grass. I mean, because one of the practices for getting rid of ryegrass in a hay field or ryegrass on baseball fields or in your yard is to go with a light dose of glyphosate or Roundup of some type, you know, over the top of it, and that'll kill the ryegrass. And well, it used to.
Yeah, well, now we're getting, our ryegrass is getting
resistant
to glyphosate now.
And it's probably from that light rate that people are
exactly
using.
That's what
their yards and baseball fields and stuff, because it used to hammer it.
Yes,
and it hammered all your little annual weeds and used to hammer everything.
I use it for my yard because it's so easy. You know, I can spray it when the Bermuda grass is dormant. It knocks out hen bit. Well, not as hen bit's even getting resistant too. But it's just, it doesn't hurt your grass in your yard. But, you know, they're even doing it now in hay pastures, you know. There's people that go in January and February and spray their entire hay pasture with Roundup just because they don't want to deal with the ryegrass, you know.
You know, even in corn farming, I mean, whenever they first came out with Roundup Ready, I'm not quite old enough to know exactly what the rate was when it first started, but I remember a time when it was like 24 ounces per acre would hammer just about everything. And then it went up to a quart per acre, and now we're up to 40 ounces per acre. I mean, so things just keep on building more and more resistance to it, and so it doesn't work like it used to. And so, like you said, it's no easy task getting rid of that Bermuda grass.
No.
But it is, like, the state gives you all the chemical for it, so that really helps with that.
And I just want to mention, too, briefly, because I know a lot of the landowners that we get in, because I get phone calls all the time. We need to talk about chemicals, because a lot of people have some very missed thoughts about chemicals, you know, and for rightfully so. You know, thank goodness we have the EPA and regulations and everything else, but some people are anti-chemical for this process, you know, whether it be spraying brush and yopon management or glyphosate. And they look for other alternatives to kill it. And really and truly, in my opinion, there's just not another option for killing an exotic warm season grass other than like solarization. Like basically you get a big giant piece of plastic, lay it out over the top of it, and let the sun cook it and bake it. You know, that'll get rid of it. But on a pasture scale.
When you're talking wildlife restoration scale,
that's not realistic.
Yeah, on
a 30-acre scale,
it's
not realistic. And chemical is the only method that we have to get rid of that Bermuda grass and those exotic ones, because they're tough.
Well, one thing you are not going to do is plow Bermuda grass.
No,
it loves to be plowed.
You're not going
to
plow it out.
One of the best methods you could have for a coastal hayfield is
plow it in the spring.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Plow it in the spring, and it loves to drag those roots around.
Yes.
And, you know, before Roundup Ready, I remember we had spots of Bermuda grass in cornfields, and you take your plow and run it through there, and it would drag those roots all over the field, and it spread Bermuda grass like crazy.
Yep.
And, of course, now, over the years of using chemicals and stuff, well, it has gotten rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing, though, like how tough that stuff actually is.
Yes. And like I said, I'm not a giant advocate of eating plants that have been sprayed with Roundup. But I am an advocate for using glyphosate, mainly because it's wildlife-friendly, it's water-friendly. It doesn't move in the soil. It doesn't have a residual. Basically, it's a contact killer. So from a restoration standpoint, it's one of the best things we've got out there, glyphosate, for these exotic warm season grasses. You know, and right now it's still working on killing, you know, the Bermuda, the big ones, the big bad ones. Bahia, which MSM works really good on Bahia grass, for sure. MSM will smoke Bahia, you know, but you got to be careful with MSM. It's not a restricted use pest herbicide, but it also smoke oak trees, too.
That's meant sulfuron, Chancey's talking about.
Yeah.
MSM.
It's great weed killer, and it definitely serves its purpose. I use it, but number one, don't spray anything under your drip lines of your oak trees, even Roundup. I don't even like spraying glyphosate under drip lines around trees. But MSM, especially if you're going to be using this in your yard, Do not put it under the drip line of any tree.
Trees hate MSM, huh?
Yes.
See, I did not even know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you follow the right dose, this is another thing too, people. Always follow. If you follow the label on that product. It works. Follow it. Don't think you can double it or dose it. But you know as well as I do, when you go to spraying your yard and spraying around trees, sometimes you have a little bit of overlap. So if you're spraying at the right rate, and you have an overlap in one of those spots, it just got double rate.
Well, and so
that can be problems. It may not kill your oak tree, but it dang sure ding it.
And typical rate for that is 0.3 pounds per acre, but I don't know what the rate of it is for using in a, like, in a yard, for instance. But
well, it's about the same for to get rid of.
Per 1,000 square feet, I mean.
Yeah,
I don't
point
know how
three.
To convert
yeah,
that.
It's 0.3 ounces. So it's a very, very minor amount, but it's a slow killer. It kills slowly, but it kills dead.
It's, yes.
Yeah.
And, it's a broadleaf killer that will smoke Bahia grass.
Yeah. And on our weedy, I've done it with Tim. I have sprayed MSM based stuff on particular weedy Bahia grass fields because it seems to work. And then followed up the treatment with Roundup, like hit it with an MSM based herbicide first to get rid of. Because I mean, it'll smoke Bahia grass, gets rid of the rhizomes, kills them, and then maybe the second or the third spraying, hit it with a low dose of glyphosate, you know, like maybe 2 or 1 quart per acre.
Right, and so, you know, you ask yourself, well, why is this important? Why do we got to get rid of Bermuda grass? So the reason for it is, and I remember Chansey being probably 13 years old, and we used to talk about what happened to the quail in this area and why did they disappear. And I'll never forget you telling me that one of the biggest problems they ran into was Bermuda grass, or, you know, coastal Bermuda grass, because they typically can't move through it.
Well, and there's no seed source there either.
You're telling me that you got to picture a quail as being like a softball and, you know, lay it in the grass, and you got to be able to see the tip of the softball up over, you know, over the top of the grass and give them something to hide behind and look over.
Yeah, and a little bitty baby, think about walking through it, or, you know, they need species that produce a lot of seed, which brings in bugs and, you know, everything else like that. Little baby quail and turkey are eating bugs. That's where they're getting their protein, bugs, spiders, all that stuff. So the more native and diversity you have, the more bugs and other species you have. Whereas Bermuda grass, a solid, beautiful Bermuda grass, although it's appealing to our eye, it looks great. And
beautiful.
Use your hay, yeah, but it's a biological desert, really, for anything.
Deer and goats will starve to death on it.
Yeah, they'll starve to death on it. There's no place for them to fawn. You know, there's no fawning cover in them. You know, even if you got some trees out there and it's all Bermuda, it's not much use for wildlife. So the reason that we've got to get rid of is, number one, it's not much use, but number two, native grasses are very, very, very difficult to establish. And so you need everything going for you. And the main thing you need going for you is native warm season grasses. They're called warm season because they mostly grow in the warm season, which is, you know, late spring, summer. That's when they start really getting after it. And if you've got an established seed source of an exotic warm season grass there, the little tiny native grass plant, it spends a lot of time. It doesn't have much new energy, you know, at first, but it spends a lot of time developing a root system. And if you got competition there, it's just going to get outcompeted. And competition is a game changer. It's a killer. It's a game ender for native grass. I've done it. I've planted for people that are anti-herbicide, and they just want to drill into Bahia or drill into it. And I've told them, I'm like, you're going to be lucky if you get 1 or 3%, and that's going to be in the bare spots. And it's true. I've even done it myself on my property, just drilled in it to see what would happen, and it just doesn't work.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is a really neat idea, and I'll get your opinion on this too. So a guy comes in the feed store this week, and he says there was a gentleman in front of him that wanted Bermuda grass seed.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, how do I plant this little stuff? And I said, man, I said, you know, it's only like 4 pounds per acre. It takes very little of it. It's a small seed. I said, you can't plant it too deep. You know, your best way is just to spread it out, kind of press it in. And this guy behind him in line says, you know the best way to plant that Bermuda grass seed? And he said, how's that? And he said, to mix it in your cow feed, and then cattle will eat it, and that they'll crap it out, and then that the Bermuda grass seed's got like a perfect little breeding ground to grow inside of that manure. I never thought about that.
I don't know if that's true or not. I have no idea. But
it's a great thought.
Yeah, I know it works for mesquites.
Does it work for native grasses?
I don't believe so, but you know, I don't know. I've never heard that.
I mean, if you think about it, like you said, it works great for mesquite beans. It works great for that. I don't know if the digestion process messes up the Bermuda grass.
I would think
seed
between them chewing their cud and also the microbes and stuff that used to break down, that it probably, you know, I don't know. I'll have to call Henry Hilscher on that. He would know. You know, he's a nutritionist.
I thought about that.
Guy.
I mean, a lot of the seeds have to be, you know, scarified some kind of
the woody plants, for sure. I know they pass through bird. I mean, look at the seeds, but as far as native grass, I've never heard that. But you know what? You know, you learn something every day.
Well,
I don't know.
Back to the feed store stories that really made me just think. A guy comes in the other day and says, I planted a bunch of pepper seeds, and he said not one of them things came up. And I was like, that's something. And so I got to researching it, and apparently they have to go through a freeze. Like, you have to put those seeds in a freezer before you plant them for them to germinate.
Yeah.
Didn't know that either.
Yeah, a lot of plants have to be scarified, you know.
So I don't know if, like I said, if that actually helps, you know, the germination of some of those native grasses or that type, because they're bound to be designed to be eaten by wildlife and by animals.
Yeah, yeah.
So therefore, you would think it would be beneficial.
I think a lot of their motive was of getting planted was, you know, number one, some of the native grasses have long arms and everything, so they stick to animals' fur and stuff like that as far as dispersal. And then also, you know, they don't need to be planted deep at all, no more than a quarter or a half inch, unless you're like gamma grass, it can be planted up to an inch. But, you know, I think just hoof action from proper grazing during the fall when they're setting seed, you know, help plant a whole lot of them. I really do. You know, I know if you shred in the fall high, you can really, a blue stem specifically, when it's blooming, when it's got seed on it, you can help spread it. And it does, it makes your shredder good, and it disperses the seed, because that's what I've done on some of the places that I had planted native grass, and it didn't get a good established, like maybe 50% of it came up. But I've just maintained it by shredding it in the, you know, during that time, and it has really, really spread since.
Well, and a lot of times that seed gets on top of your shredder, and that shredder carries it.
Sure.
And it spreads it around, too.
Sure. But as far as animals eating it and planting it, I don't know. I've never seen it, never heard that, but, you know, like I said, learn something every day.
Yeah, and so that's the reason that we'd like to get rid of the Bermuda grass.
Yeah, competition is the main problem for native grass. So the way that works, after you've got all that stuff killed, you generally take a no-till drill through the pub project, and you drill the native grass into the thatch that's left over with no competition, and then you cross your fingers and you want a normal year. Generally, that planting's done in the winter through early spring.
And I'm not sure, Chansey, did we say what PUB project stands for?
Pastures for Upland Birds.
Pastures for Upland Birds.
Designed and it's focused for the Blackland Prairie and kind of the post-oak savanna. But I think, you know, the Blackland Prairie of our region is high priority. You know, very high priority, because we just don't have much of it. You know, and as we talked, you know, we don't have much quail left anymore. We don't have much turkey left anymore.
Well, so many people out in our area out there try those, what do they call those little surrogate things for the for the quail? I forget what they're called.
Yeah, surrogate, something like that.
Yeah, and so, you know, they set that up, and every once in a while, I know where one is, and as the crow flies from my house, it's probably like 5 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And once every 2 or 3 years, we'll get a quail that'll make it out that far, but then they'll disappear too.
Yeah, the habitat's not congruent and are, you know, contiguous enough. You know, you've got, like, there's still isolated pockets of quail in the Blackland Prairie. You know, well, I know there was 10 years ago, and I would say maybe even a somewhat breeding population, you know, but they're isolated. Yeah, so if something happens to them, you know, like some little catastrophe that's localized, you know, say your nest fills all of a sudden and there's no population or young for that year, you know, those little isolated pockets are very, very vulnerable. And so what the PUB project is trying to do is put in more habitat. And the more habitat, you can get corridors and animals don't have to move as far from block to block or place to place, you know, because if you think about in the Blackland Prairie, the only time you look at it in the wintertime, it's all plowed bird dirt, you know. And then I guess if a quail wanted to move, you know, because I think he can't cross bare ground, a hawk could get him in a second. If he really wanted to move from one area around Buckholz, you know, 5 miles down the road to another area, he'd basically have to do it in the summertime when all the corn's up, you know. And a lot of them probably try that, you know. But still, if you had blocks of habitat a lot closer, you know, it'd just be better ability to survive and reproduce. And not only that, can your babies survive and reproduce? So that's what that program's all about, increasing habitat.
Okay, and so there's lots of different ways out there of getting rid of all this, like Bermuda grass and all that type of stuff. Chansey actually will do that for you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he takes care of a lot of projects like that for, you know, he's well known with the state and knows their program well and has all the equipment for getting rid of a lot of that stuff. And there's actually a new system, I guess.
Yeah, these new technologies I'm very, very interested in, because I honestly, like I said, I do have the equipment and I do it. But I don't like spraying. I don't care for it, you know. It's just, so I'd rather, if there's another way around or a new technology, I'm all about it.
Well, a lot of the places you're working are just so rough.
Yes.
You know, and so there is a lot of new technologies coming out. I guess one of those, I guess, would be, you know, spraying with drones. And there's a good friend of mine, Lance Green, who, man, I taught in school. How many years ago, Lance?
Oh, I don't even want to say.
Oh, you're not that old.
10 years ago?
Yeah, welcome with us. Welcome with us, Lance. It's been a long time since me and Lance were standing together on the sidelines and playing yeoman football and just enjoyed every day of being around Lance. Just a real good guy. His dad's a good friend of mine in Chansey's. And if you've been listening long enough, you may remember his brother Lance was on with us, man, back three years ago or so.
Yeah.
Landon was, and so here we are with Lance now, all these years later, and Lance, tell us a little bit, what all you done since high school, my friend?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on, guys. So out of high school, went to college, went to Sam, had to get a degree. Unfortunately, I'm glad that's over with, but ended up getting out. I actually got in touch with somebody who got me a job in the Valley. Spent, I guess, about 5 years in the Valley working for Nutrien Ag Solutions. So I'm just, I'm still with the same company. I just got transferred up here to the Taylor area. And so, yeah, just working as a salesman in retail, providing farmers and ranchers with chemical crop, chemical seed and fertilizer. Yeah.
Yeah, and now Lance is back at home on the Blackland Prairie.
Yes, sir. That's right. And yeah, me and my middle brother, we actually started this drone application business. And he's going to be the one doing the piloting, and I'm kind of helping him with, setting up making sure we're applying the right chemicals or putting out the right kind of seed and dealing with most of the farmers and the ranchers, just because I kind of already do that, you know, day to day anyway. So it kind of just fits.
Yeah. And so now, and I mean, Lance, without you getting yourself in trouble, my friend, you got to mention your wife, Sam, who also I taught years ago just an excellent, excellent person herself. And she is now in vet school too, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. She's actually about to finish up her last year of schooling, and she will then be starting her rotations, her clinical rotations. So she was part of the first class at the Texas Tech Vet School.
Awesome.
She was the inaugural class. They've kind of been the guinea pigs to see how this program goes. But man, she's had nothing but good things to say. I mean, it's very rural driven. Like, they want Texas, and they kind of partner with New Mexico too. They want Texas and New Mexico kids to come in, and they want these kids to come back to Texas and New Mexico and work in rural, you know, veterinary medicine. So a lot of large animal production that they focus on, you know, obviously being up in the Panhandle, a lot of feedlots and big ranches up there. So yeah, no, she'll be, hopefully, I guess about a year, little over a year, she'll be finished up. And yeah, her goal, obviously, come back here. And I think there's a need for a vet around this area as well. So,
Yes.
Maybe one day she'll have her own clinic. Who knows?
There's a huge need. And like I said, we couldn't go without mentioning her. And now if we need an expert on just about everything, we could just call Lance's house, because, man, we got a veterinarian and a chemical expert and a drone flying expert. I mean, good Lord.
And this drone technology is something I know very little about, Lance. And, and I don't know, Brad probably knows more than I do. But, man, if you can just expound on it, like, tell us about it, how it works, and, you know, your capabilities and how you do it and just the process, how it works.
Yeah. So it is a pretty new technology. So it's like evolving. I mean, since we bought the one that we have back in January, these drones, the DJI, the company that we are flying with, They are a Chinese-based company, obviously, and they're released. They have to release them first over there, and then, you know, the U.S. has to approve them to be flown in the States. But they've already come out with two new editions of this, like bigger and better, since the T-40 that we have, you know, that we purchased. There's now a T-50 and a T-60. So with our drone in specific, though, we can carry 10 gallons of liquid at a time, or if we're doing dry, we can also do dry applications, dry fertilizer. Something that we've been looking into is maybe doing some AffliGuard applications on corn, you know, in certain areas where maybe a plane can't get to. It can carry 110, 120 pounds of dry product at a time if you're slinging out dry fertilizer or, you know, whatever. Seed, we can also, you know, do seed applications with that. So it works kind of the same way your tractors do as far as the mapping goes. You can map these fields. It's all done through GPS. We are able to handle it manually, but that's really only in specific situations where maybe you're going down a tight lane that it's not wanting to do automatically. You've got obstacles around you. Trees are a big one when we've been doing pasture work. Trees. Trees are a major concern that we have to go around manually most of the time because the drone just kind of does not like it whenever it tries to. It'll try and do it automatically. It'll try and avoid them automatically. And we've had a couple little scares where we're like, yeah, that definitely was about to go straight into that tree. So it's got an object avoidance mechanism,
yes. But you know, if you're going too fast or something, maybe a lag time with it.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's actually pretty good, but especially when you have a full payload, you're running, you know, 30 feet per second with that drone, and it needs to come to a halt because it senses that object.
Sure.
It can get a little squirrely, you know. It's a lot of weight that little drone is carrying, so it can just be a little scary at times. You just got to watch it.
Yeah, because, I mean, 10 gallons, that's roughly 100 pounds. That's a lot of weight that sucker's
carrying. Yeah, sure is.
Now, that's actually amazing that they could handle that.
Me too, and that's battery, huh? That's battery operated. Yes. Yeah, got it. That's unreal.
And so what kind of rates, what kind of rates, Lance, will that thing spray? Like how many gallons per acre?
You can make it do whatever you want to, but to do it efficiently, we've been running 2 and 3 gallon per acre rates. So it's going to be similar to your airplane application, but we've been kind of toying with it. We've been doing a little bit of 2, a little bit of 3. Yesterday we were spraying some stuff that was really grown up. And so we went with 3 and we're just kind of playing with it because how this drone worked, it's got these spinner discs on it it's got 2 different motors, where it spits out this liquid. And it goes onto it almost like a spinner disc plate. That spinner disc kind of shoots it out, slings it out, and then the propellers create almost this vortex that the product will go down, kind of swirl back up, and then shoot down into the canopy. It's you kind of have to see it to kind of understand exactly how it works. But it's able to run at such a light volume because the coverage is actually really, really good. If you have your parameters set up right, it's kind of like you have to have the right speed, you have to have the right height, you have to have the right droplet size to make it all kind of work together. So there's a lot of learning that we still have to do and trying to look out to people who have been doing it for the last few years and learn from them, you know, to make sure that we're keeping our spray patterns, you know, good.
Yeah, so you're literally spraying like literally straight chemical, like there's very little water with it.
It just depends. I mean, like, For what we were, you know, with Duracor, you've got 16 to 20 ounce rate that you're spraying out. And then the rest would be water, you know, so like a gallon, gallon and a half of water or whatever, you know, it comes out to. We're sticking surfactants in too, so that takes up a little room. But yeah, it's very, very low volume overall.
And so I've seen that you like a lot of mesquite work that you've been able to get here lately, and it's getting to be that time of the year too to start hammering those things, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So we just have to wait a little longer for the soil temp to kind of increase because you want it to be 75 degrees at a 12 inch depth. So we're just waiting on that. And then it'll be pretty much go time as long as you don't want to spray right after a rain whenever it's putting on new growth. There's a couple little odds and ends that you got to kind of watch for. But pretty much when that soil temp gets right, we'll be doing some mesquite application as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry about a flat tire or anything, do you?
No.
No, you don't. And when those mesquite get real big, you know, you can't get in there with something on the ground. And And unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, it has to be a certain size for an airplane to justify it.
So small areas are kind of out, but this is perfect for like small landowners that's got a mesquite problem.
Exactly. Yes, sir. Yeah, what's that's the rate, goal, at least. We'll see.
Yeah, that's great. No, awesome, awesome stuff. What's the rate on spraying those mesquites? Like, is it different for big, mature mesquites versus the small ones, or do you spray the same amount every time? With the foliar spray, just right on top of the leaf.
Yeah, no. So if you're going just a straight broadcast across the field and not trying to do, like, individual spot treatment, which we haven't really toyed around with. I think that's where that mapping comes into play. You can map the field and then choose to go in and tell it to spot spray on certain areas. But
yeah,
we haven't dove into that yet. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. But as far as a broadcast application, yeah, same rate. A lot of guys are going 2 gallons per acre. We actually sprayed 55 acres last August. I actually hired a drone. That's kind of what got me into it. Was I hired a drone guy from Loxahatchee. That was the closest one I could find who would do it. And he came down and sprayed a big mesquite, 15, 20 foot tall mesquites that were, you know, shredded. You could tell they had been shredded back in the day. I mean, they just
hard to kill.
Really tough to kill. Yes, very hard to kill. And he came out and did 2 gallons per acre, got great coverage. I mean, when the drone is spraying, you're kind of sitting there and you're like, man, is this going to work? Like, it. I mean, that day I was really questioning it. And what do you know, two, 3 weeks later, I mean, the foliage was completely dead. He didn't miss a single tree where he actually sprayed. I mean, it just, yeah, it's kind of amazing. You gotta watch it and then come back a couple weeks later to actually make sure that it worked. But it never fails. It's worked every time.
And that's called, that chemical lands mostly spraying on, that's called Envora, right?
Yeah. That's the new one that has really looked promising on mesquite, and then something that it might even be better on compared to, you know, the traditional chemicals that we use is Wesatch. It seems to be way ahead on Wesatch as well, you know, which is more a South Texas problem. But yeah, it looks to be, and it's a great broadleaf herbicide as well. Like, a lot of people don't realize that not only is it great on mesquite and Wesatch, but it is an excellent broadleaf herbicide too.
Yeah, what does it cost per acre on that chemical, roughly? Do you know?
So you're probably, it depends on what rate you want to run. A lot of guys are running 24 ounces. I believe that's going to run you about $30. I mean, it's not a cheap application by any means. I think it's somewhere between $30 and $35 for the chemical.
Probably about like twice as much as what your DuraCore or something like that is.
Yeah, it's going to be more expensive. The residual that you're going to get with the Envora, though, is going to be vastly better. I can't really prove it, but where we sprayed those mesquites with that Envora, the ground under those mesquites this spring is cleaner than where we did not spray the mesquites at. So I feel like there's something to that chemical having really some good residual just from that, and hearing guys spraying it on their pasture too, because some guys are trying it out on their pasture ground too.
Oh, well, that's good to know, especially if we got little scattered mesquites here and there.
Sure.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Have you seen how that stuff works, Lance, on something like the mesquites that have been cut off time and time again in a hay field or something like that?
I have not. I've been curious about that. Could a hay guy go out and he's got the, you know, once he does a cutting and or before, you know, the spring cuttings, could he go out and just kind of apply Envora as a broadcast and take care of those little pesky mesquites that he has to cut over every year? I don't know if there's enough tissue foliage there to translocate down into the roots effectively. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I was wondering if you've seen that yet. I know it's pretty new and probably something that you have not seen yet, but that's what I was curious about, is if you've seen that yet by chance, because those suckers, those little mesquites in those hay fields, they've got quite a root system.
They do. And they don't look like much, but I'm sure if you had somebody go in there and grub them, pull them up and pull that root out, it would be pretty impressive, I imagine.
It is indeed. And like Chancey said, this is a beneficial practice, you know, especially for these habitat restoration things that's going on. Because a lot of that ground is pretty rough.
Yeah.
I mean,
or it's in isolated areas that are hard to get to across the creek, or there's no, you know, it's just access is sometimes an issue for these areas. And that drone, heck, don't need a bridge to fly.
He's that's like, right.
Yeah, no, that's true. I hadn't really thought much about that one. I think it would be a great fit, though, like you're saying, for certain situations like that. Hard to reach areas could definitely work, because most of the time an airplane's not going to catch those little spots.
No, you know, problem areas. Yes, sir.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we don't want to take too much business away from our good buddy Michael Ranspot. But
yeah, no, definitely not. We would never go and try and spray 1,000 acres, you know, out in the middle of nowhere and try and compete with an airplane. We know our place.
Yeah, no, and I'm going to get Lance to come out and spray some mesquites for us as soon as it, like Lance said, when it warms up a little bit and it gets to be that time.
I think it's a niche market for sure. That is a neat technology, Lance, absolutely.
Yeah, and so, Lance, yeah. Give us some contact information, my friend.
Okay, yeah, sure. If you want to reach out, we're on Facebook, Green Custom Application. You can reach me, 254-482-5665. If you have any questions or want to just chat, just give me a holler.
Okay, my friend. Well, Lance, it sure was good talking to you and catching up with you again, old buddy.
No, thank you both for having me on. I love talking about this stuff, so anytime.
You got it, my friend, and from now on, you will be our chemical expert.
All right. Man, thanks, Brad.
We appreciate you, bud. Yeah, that way, yes, if you get bad information, it's your fault, not ours.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
All right,
just what I needed.
Good seeing you, Lance.
Yes, sir. Talk to y'all later.
All right. So that was our old buddy Lance there. And so good information there. And like I said, that's a heck of a good way of doing that. You know, getting back to it, Chansey, there's lots of ways of doing that. We talked to Colton a while back about, you know, the mulching and that way of getting rid of some of that underbrush and that type of stuff. And you've worked on top of some of the stuff that he's done.
Yeah, I followed behind Colton, and he does excellent work with mulching. All these tools in these toolkits, y'all, that we mentioned, they have their place, you know, and some of them work in conjunction. But, you know, we were talking about these pub projects, and now we just mentioned the spraying, and we just mentioned Colton as well, and I just want to follow up by that, because Parks and Wildlife also has a program in that's specific for the postal savanna area. So if you're familiar with the
postal... So we got the pub and the Blackland.
We got the pub and the Blackland. And the guys that ramrod this one is the state herpetologist. His name is Paul Crump. Excellent guy. Excellent biologist. And also Tim Sigmund that runs the pub. He helps a lot, and they're doing lots and lots of landowner workshops in our area right now in Milam County, Burleson County, Robertson County, targeting these post-oak savanna, smaller type acreages, you know, or are larger. They're just looking for landowners that would be interested in this project, and it's mirrored off the pub project. I don't know if they've named it yet, but basically what they're doing is they're looking for areas that would be potential Houston toad habitat. Houston toad, if you don't know it, that's an endemic species to Texas. It's an endangered species, and they occur in Milam County. They occur in Robertson County historically, and there was. But through land use, like we talked about, you know, it's not just the post Blackland prairie. It's also the post-oak savanna. It's been mismanaged or undergrazed or lack of fire. And so much of our savanna area, which used to produce and support healthy savanna woodland ecosystems or forest ecosystems, whether it be Bass Trop or up in the post oak savanna around our neck of woods, where it's mainly just post oaks, they have been encroached by shade tolerant underbrush species and grown into the canopies. And the main majority is yaupon. And yaupon in these areas become thick, they become dense, they become rank, they lose diversity, they lose herbaceous life. You take out herbaceous species and you take out and replace it with woody species. Basically, you take, you know, the savanna, turn it into a dense monoculture of basically a handful of species. It's not usable space for turkey, quail, or Houston toads. And Houston toads are a great indicator species, because if you have Houston toads and you've got a healthy toad population, then chances are you've got a very healthy forest habitat or woodland habitat.
So would you say that the Houston toad is almost like endangered around here?
It's definitely endangered. It is endangered species. And, you know, I used to do surveys for Houston toads and still do occasionally when we were doing listening for them. And, you know, I heard some just on the other side of Hearn 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I heard some. But those toads haven't been heard, I think, since then. And a lot of it, you know, is because the habitat. Yeah, there might be an adult out there that's surviving, and he's even reproducing, but can his baby survive and reproduce?
Well, in the biology of the Houston toad, it can't survive in the black land.
No, they're a deep sand species.
That's why this program is only beneficial for the
post-oak savannah. Like I said, they kind of mirrored it off of the PUB project, so they pay for... And I don't know as much details because I think it's on a property and case-by-case basis. But if y'all are south of Highway 79 in Milam County and you're in those deep, deep sands where you've got bluejack oak and you've got dense yaupon and maybe some curly threon and, you know those dense, xeric, very sandy, sandy habitats, deep, deep sands. That was a habitat for the Houston toad.
Because they have to burrow into
They burrow into the ground. So they come out early, early in the wintertime, you know, maybe even early January, and they'll start breeding season, you know, and they'll breed up until about May, something like that. But historically, when the droughts would come, they would go back down and burrow down into these deep sands. And that protected them from fires, it protected them from everything. But they needed these natural little pools, you know. Small, a lot of them, their breeding ponds tend to avoid pools that are perennial water. So they need these little vernal pools that occur in woodlands and woodland sloughs, you know, or savanna, meadow, wet prairies that dry up, you know, that dry up pretty soon. They have water during for the tadpole size, and then they dry up. Because if they dry up, then there's no perennial herbivory fish. And if they dry up fast enough, there's not really any, like, dragonfly larva or as much predators in there. They seek out those areas like that. Hillside seeps. If you're in that area and you're, like, you're in the post-oak savanna and you have some of those dense, you see those areas with hillside seeps that have a little bit of water in the spring. You know, they might have some rushes or maybe some wax myrtle growing around them, and they make a little vernal pool there. That's good breeding habitat for the toad. The problem is many of those areas aren't surrounded by savanna anymore. Many of those areas still exist, but they're surrounded by dense yaupon and have been overtaken, and those babies can't manage it, you know, the little toadlets when they get out. And it's a whole host of different things, but if you're managing and making habitat for the Houston toad, in turn, you're doing awesome management for white-tailed deer. You're doing awesome management for wild turkey. You're doing awesome management for all your grassland songbirds. You're doing awesome wildlife management for your upland birds like quail. So you're managing for toad, because like a lot of my landowners, you know, they just, you know, they're a deer guy or whatever. They're like, well, what's the toad good for? You know, what's a toad do for me? Well, if you got toads and you're managing for toads, everything else is sinking good too. And so that project, it's focused on toad, but it's mainly focused on habitat restoration within the post-oak savanna, which is a good win thing. And like I said, it's a cost share program. I think they've streamlined the thing. There's several workshops. I wish I had that information with me right now, but there's several workshops going to be this summer and fall, you know, that just... Tim will be there and all these other biologists and Paul discussing how this process works and the way that we do it. But generally the process is you go in there and you mulch it in the fall, you know, spring. You mulch out all the understory, take out all those nauseous eastern red cedars, all the yaupon, these dense, dense areas, and you leave the larger hardwoods. You leave the oaks and the hickories, you know, maybe some of the larger elms, and you create a savanna. Then you can either, once that mulching's done, and it's fairly expensive, but with what it does, it's very important. Number one, it's better for these projects than a dozer. And the reason is because in these areas, it's mostly post-oaks. And a lot of these areas have yaupon that are enrooted. Their roots are rooted with the post-oak trees, or they have eastern red cedars or elms growing up underneath these post-oak trees and now have grown up. And the mulching, you have very, very little soil disturbance. It just takes it down to the ground, leaves the mulch there, you know, eventually a rot. Some places are thicker. But whereas if you're going there and with a dozer, bulldozing those out of there and ripping them out of there, it really disturbs, even if you're avoiding the post-oaks, it disturbs the root systems. And all oaks don't like their roots messed with, but post-oaks in particular do not like their roots messed with. I'm not saying it's going to kill that tree, but it will ding it. And more than likely, it will not kill it the first year or the second year or even the third year. But sometimes it might be 5 years before that tree dies. And you're like, well, why did my tree die? You know, but it all probably started back with having its roots jacked with along, you know, several years ago. And eventually it's just a slow kill.
Well, and the mulch, too, probably helps with the things like the Houston toad.
Well, like, you know, if it's real, it depends on how dense, but, you know, generally when I followed behind Colton and seen, you know, he does, it spreads it out fairly well. You know, so they've mulched these areas, and then one of the options is to come in there and broadcast these areas. You know, broadcast them with native grass, which we've done. You know, because these areas, there's gullies, there's ravines, there's hills. Some of it's rough ground, you know, and so you can't really get a drill in there. I mean, I guess you could, but, you know, some of the tree spacing is 60 to 80% canopy cover, you know. So it's hard to get a tractor and a drill in there. So broadcasting is kind of, you know, one of your only options, which is a little bit cheaper and it goes quicker. But you don't have to do that because when you open these areas up through that mulching process, you have a native seed bank there. And you would be very surprised what will come up that's been sitting in there in the ground just from exposing it to the ground and taking out the shade and letting the soils, the temperature rise up a little bit so some of those seeds can germinate.
Well, you get a lot of new oaks and those types of things,
Oh, yeah, you get a lot of new oaks, too. But one of the things with this mulching that is mandatory is critical because if you go in there and you do some work on these areas in the post-oak savanna and you don't do a follower treatment with herbicide, then you can basically, you've created a monster. You've created more of a problem because in general, what I've noticed, and I'm not saying when they've mulched an area and kind of like what I say, rough mulched it, Colton and them, they can make it look like a park, make it look awesome, but it takes a little bit more time. So depending on the amount of area, there's a cost ratio thing. Okay, do I want it mulched all done, you know, and it not look exactly like a park because it's 100 acres and then save me a little bit of money up front. So it's one of those things.
Or have a few sticks on the ground.
Yeah, I have a few sticks on the ground. Generally, with those areas, you know, there's going to be, once a yopons are going to root sprout, and when they do, they have multiple root sprouts. And you better get them within that first growing season, because after that, generally, they get too tall that you don't have, can't really get a sprayer in there, or they're too tall to even use a sprayer because you've got to be dealing with the tree canopy and vines and everything else, too. You need to get in there that first growing season and hit them with the herbicide treatment. And what we've been, and historically, it was all IPT, you know, which is individual plant treatment. You go out there with a 10% remedy triclopyr-4 mix and a diesel mix, 90% with backpack sprayers, or an ATV, and you stem spray the trunks at about 3 ounces per acre. I mean, 3 ounces per stem, which, y'all, is extremely time-consuming. It's very difficult, challenging work if you're on a backpack on foot going across there. And not only that, some of these areas have greater than 300 stems per acre. And some of them are...
That takes a lot of water.
Some of them are 1,000-plus stems per acre. Some of them I've seen are even 2,000 stems per acre. And trust me, as a guy that's had the backpack sprayer on his back, you don't want to IPT more than about an acre of that. So
you know, the funny thing is, my dad calls me yesterday, and he said, hey, there's a garage sale next to one of these pastures we lease. He said, lady's got a backpack sprayer on there for sale that's brand new. Do you want it? And I said, heck no.
Yeah.
Man, that stuff spills all over the top of you, and it's pretty tough to hook on once you get that thing full.
Yeah, and you know, you got, if they're carrying 4 gallons, you know, I mean, you've got 4 gallons of diesel in your back, so I mean, you're carrying around 40 pounds, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And so now this broadcast spray treatment that you have, what is the race? What are you mixing
and
that?
So this is another thing where I like the broadcast treatment area. Because number one, if you're spraying that diesel, you're going to have some residual, and it's going to, so if you do have native grasses coming back, anywhere that diesel's going to hit, it's going to kill them. You know, it's going to hit it. Whereas the broadcast method, you're not running 10%, you're only running a 2.8% mix. That's all you're running. 2.8% triclopyr 4, you know, remedy 4, and 2.8% MSO. And MSO is a surfactant, an oil base. It's called methylated seed oil. And it's a very good surfactant. And I, in my opinion, it is a game changer. It is a game changer because it also, it's oily. You put it out with a tip that puts a big drop on it. So you want the yopon about 16 to 20 inches tall that's bushy. So it's got a lot of surface area and the amount of numbers of leaves. That way, you can get the chemical in there. It's slow killer. Like, those yopines might stay green for 2 to 3 weeks, but they'll eventually get less and less and less. But that oil on there, I think it helps get the chemical down into the root system. And so far, everything we've done, we've had really, really good success on it and probably got an 80% kill, which is fathomable. And most of where we didn't get kills, it's just area with a broadcast. You're driving through trees and you're driving through brush piles and you're driving through downfall. So when you go by a tree, you might have shadow area where if there's a bush behind it on the other side that didn't get it, or either, you know, just human error navigating through some of these difficult to reach areas. But that mixture is being very effective, and I even used it on my place this year, and I've used it on some of the landowners that seem to be very happy with it. And I've asked them this spring, I was like, okay, that stuff that we did last summer, I was like, I know it's top killed, but none of it, I have zero root sprouts coming up back right now. And they're like, same thing, everywhere that's been top killed, I see no root sprouts coming up. That method seems to be very, very beneficial. It's a lot more cost effective than IPT on a large scale. And that's the rate that we're using, 2.8% Remedy 4, Triclopyr 4, and 2.8% up. And we broadcast it on ATV, and it's best to have a boomless sprayer, one that shoots out.
That you won't hit on trees.
That you won't hit on trees, that's got minimum number tips, because I'm telling you, you're driving through rough places, things are trying to poke you in the eyes, they're trying to poke you in the throat, you're trying to navigate, you're trying to stay on course, you don't want to miss a spot, you're constantly looking behind you, you're looking in front of you, so lots of things going on in there that you're watching out for. Every 100 yards or so, you got to stop and pull a stick out from underneath your machine that's caught underneath it, so...
And that's where Lance's drone comes in handy.
Yeah, but see, that's what I was wondering about him, you know, trees. He said that he's having problems with trees. I'm sure that's just a technology they'll get worked with. But I'm interested in if those drones, and I should have asked him this, can those drones fly under a canopy, a tree of, say, you know, like a spacing of, because those areas probably have between 200 and 400 trees per acre is what we're...
Big trees.
Yeah, big trees. 10-inch, 8 to 10-inch trees and larger. So that's what we're leaving. Something that's going to give us about a canopy cover of about 60 to 80%, you know, so it gets enough sunlight in the ground to grow a savanna. But, you know, that's... But there are also vines that... Because when those mulchers go through there, you know, they mulch it off of the ground, but if there was a vine hanging down, those vines are hanging, so... You know, I'm just wondering how it can navigate those, because I tell you, it's if it can do that, it'll be a great technology for us to use as another tool in our toolbox. Yeah.
Yes, and so what's the next step once you get rid of all this underbrush? What is the next step that the state of Texas says that you do for your Houston toad?
Well, once you do the broadcast method or the IPT, whichever one, the goal is to get a savanna back into it. And then the next step right there is it may take 2 to 3 years, you know, before you can get enough fuel there to carry a prescribed fire. And that's the goal, because the way that the system was created, the way that it works, is fire would come through periodically in this area and take out all that yopon. It would top kill it and take it out, and grasses would flow, and it didn't harm the larger trees. You know, fire.
Because doesn't a lot of oaks take a fire in order to scarify the scene?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of them just need sunlight. They need sunlight to do well. And so you get these really thick, thick areas. There's just not any regeneration. You know, there's zero regeneration. So you open up, make a savanna, your acorn crops are going to be better. You're going to see more wildlife. You're going to have usable space. Right now, those thick yopon areas, they're basically usable for hogs. That's about right. And, you know, and they like those dense areas and stuff. But deer, nothing really uses those thick. And not only that, a lot of this Houston toad stuff started in 2011 when we had the Bass Trap fire. You know, Bass Trap fire, because that forest had been mismanaged for so long. They had a fuel source there that when there was a fire in a drought, you had a canopy fire and it burned the whole forest down. Well, don't you think that our yopon in these thick, thick areas around Galls and some of these Robertson County and East Milam County, when it gets summertime, you just look at that yopon. That yopon will get crispy and brittle and right there. And some of that yopon is 12, 15 feet tall up in the canopy of these trees. And it hadn't happened yet that I know of on a large scale. Thank God for it. Clock is ticking. One of these days, you know, it's very liable. We get in a bad drought. And what we consider these post-oak woodlands that have been thicketized with this yopon undergrowth are going to go up. And when it does, we're going to have a canopy fire, too. It's going to burn the whole forest
down. Great fuel.
Yeah, great fuel. And if you don't know, live yopon will burn, especially during a drought. It'll burn just like a cedar tree will in a drought. Yeah, it'll go up. So that's something, too, that we need to be mindful about, because these systems, I'll just put it this way, they're going to burn one way or the other. They're going to burn either catastrophically if we don't do anything, or we can burn them on these prescribed burns where they're safe burns and we're also maintaining and creating habitat at the same time.
makes sense. And so that's your goal with that, is to get that down to an amount of underbrush or something, you will, that you can prescribe burn, I guess.
Yes, so you got to get rid of all the underbrush and the brush, and then get an herbaceous layer of native grasses growing up underneath these oak savanna systems. And that's what they call it. All a savanna is, y'all, is a meadow or a prairie that's got scattered trees or tree clumps. You know, it's not a closed canopy forest, you know. Sunlight hits the ground, and this is where your turkey brooding area is at. This is where your fawning cover's at. This is where, you know, your quail brooding covers at and nesting cover. So this is what you want. This is what we need to strive for. In order to get there, we have to, you know, use these steps to get there. And it's a multi-year process. It ain't happening in a year, you know.
And so what are some of the grasses that they put into the blend that you're planting out there on the Houston Toad Restoration?
Little blue stem, big blue stem, Indian grass, a lot of your sand drop seeds, tons of different forbs, coreopsises, you know. There's all kinds of mixes. And now I just want to mention that the Texas Native Seeds Program, historically 20 to even 10 years ago and plus, it was hard to get native grasses that were local ecotypes. But these guys with A&M and Tony Falk down there and Megan Clayton, they've been doing excellent, excellent work. And also Parks and Wildlife and Tim Sigmund and Paul Crump, excellent biologists doing great work, getting us these local ecotype seeds. Like now we have an OK Select little blue stem. And we also have a Central Texas blue stem. We also have a Coastal Prairie little blue stem that a lot of it was collected in East Texas and Western Louisiana. It's adapted here. Whereas historically we were buying... Cimarron little blue stem from Kansas, and I've planted it, and it would come up. I could get it up, and it looked good the first year or second year, but then by year three or five, it wasn't there no more.
The heat and the drought.
The heat, it wasn't adapted to it, you know, but it was the only source that we had. And now the seed companies, Bammert Seed, Douglas King Seed, Turner Seed, Native American Seed, a lot of them have these local eco-type stuff and their availability. Also, we want to just mention another seed company, Roundstone Seed out of Kentucky. They have seed sources everywhere too, but if you're east of I-45 or basically East Milam County, they have a lot of stuff that they only have that they've collected here. So they're a good resource as well, you know. And I happen to know one of the biologists that works for them. His name's Tyler Whalen, and he's a sales rep there now, but he's also helps with establishing and getting these ecotypes and getting them out there to market to the public. So that's another big step. And between these government programs, like what Paul and Tim are doing, they'll get those native seeds, and so our success rate has gone way up.
And so, and what are some of those species of blackland prairie grasses?
A lot of the same, but you know, they're planting the more Central Texas blackland prairie versus the sandier one. You know, kind of like we have different blue bonnets. You know, you have the sandy land blue bonnet, you have the blackland prairie blue bonnet. But you know, you're planting like OK Select little blue stem, or you're planting more blackland-specific calcareous soil species and ecotypes that are collected from those areas. Not saying that a sandy one won't grow and do well, but these local ecotypes are really seeing, you know, to have big changes. And like I said, these pub projects and these past projects that they come together, the biologists get together, they get with those seed companies, they work up a mix, and it's a great mix, you know, and it's made specifically for your property to do well on your property.
This and again, there's project, that's all projects by the state of Texas, and in order to get into that program, you just contact your local
local biologist, you know, you contact your local wildlife biologist. The one for our area, his name is Bobby Alcorn. You know, you can go to Texas Parks and Wildlife website. I said there's a tab on there that said find a biologist. Click on find a biologist. Click on your county. It'll tell you who your guys are. Give them a call. Shoot them an email. You know, tell them what you got. And that's the first step.
And Chancey could help you with that too.
Yeah, I could help you with that. I mean, it's easy if you just need to find them. You know, that's probably the first step for a landowner interested, is contacting that local biologist, letting him come out and look at your property. And then he'll set up the program, because I went to school with a lot of those people that run those projects now. And, you know, we're friends. We've been friends for years. And they have money out there, and they need landowners, you know. So these are good things to look at. They're wildlife friendly, and they're important programs. And they're very, what I'm going to call, landowner friendly now, you know.
Well, good information there, my friend.
Yes, sir.
And Chancey, I think that about wraps this up then.
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. Good to be back here with y'all again. You too, bro. Always good to see my best buddy.
It was, bud. Yeah, and hopefully we can do a, get with you a little bit more now. The life is straightening out just a little bit, and we apologize for the long gap in between there, but it's always good to get here and discuss things with Chancey and put something together for you, and we hope you enjoyed that.
All righty. See you later, Brad.
All right. Thank you all for listening, and y'all have a good day.